Coming up next on Tech News Today, the Galaxy Note 7 is about to receive its kill switch. Michigan is now at the forefront of autonomous vehicle technology development. Inside Apple's secretive meeting about AI, what it's like to play Super Mario Run in an Apple store, and Stephen Hawking says Terminator 2 is right around the corner. I need a vacation. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1658, recorded Friday, December 9th, 2016. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit.
And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TNT to receive a free Tracker Bravo with any purchase.
And by LinkedIn Learning and lynda.com. Develop talent and keep skills current with expert-led on-demand e-learning. For your free Managing Technical Projects course and to request a demo for your organization, visit learning.linkedin.com/twit.
Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we tell you everything you need to know about technology that happened today. And we are the Harpo and Groucho of Tech News.
You are very grouchy today. I mean, Groucho.
Harpo doesn't speak, so.
Well, have fun doing the show.
I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Let's do this.
Yes, let's do it. Samsung's December 19th over-the-air update for the Galaxy Note 7 will stop your ability to charge your recalled device and will stop the phones from working as a mobile device at all. I say your, but please tell me that you don't still have your Note 7. The software update will roll out over the next 30 days, and everyone except right now Verizon thinks this is a great idea. While Samsung says 93% of Galaxy Note 7s have been returned, Verizon does not want to issue the newest update because they don't want users of the phones to be unable to call family, medical professionals, or first responders. That makes sense. But, I mean, they probably don't want the users of the phone to set their houses on fire either, do they?
I wouldn't think that they do. Yeah, I don't know where I stand on this one because I kind of get both sides. I can completely understand the fact that not everybody has, like, an interim solution to be phoneless until they get their money back. And some of the carriers in months past had helped kind of with that transition. I'm not saying that it's necessarily Verizon's problem to deal with, but, you know, as a show of good kind of grace for their customers, maybe they could consider doing that. I imagine, I don't know what the numbers are necessarily as far as the amount of their customers that are still, you know, holding on to their Note 7s.
Yeah, I don't know it broken down by Verizon. I know that 1,767,000 Note 7s have been sent back, which leaves 133,000 devices yet to be returned. That's 93%. 1 million is 767 is, yeah. Oh, math and notes that I took. And last month they already capped the charging, so you can't charge it more than 60%.
Right.
At this point,
People are, I mean, the people that still own them, at least the ones that you find in forums and everything, like if you go to XDA forums, which is a very popular kind of like modding community, you know, hackery sort of forum, extremely popular, large community there for mobile devices. I mean, there's all sorts of owners that are talking every day about the ways to get around the forced updates, ways to hide them so that they don't have to accept this update that, you know, it renders their battery only 60% effective, blocking them entirely, all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, some of these owners are really passionate about holding on to this phone, even though if they try and take it to the airport and fly with them, they're going to be denied. You know, there's all of these roadblocks, but yet people still want them. Maybe that's a testament to how great the phone could have been or is in light of its explosion qualities. But I mean, I imagine going one step further, there could be a point where the IMEIs are actually blocked on these devices. We're not there yet, but maybe that would be the next step. And at some point, maybe, you know, these people who are stubbornly holding on to these things just have to give in, have to hand it over.
It's time.
It's time. It's time we had the talk. The Wall Street Journal says that the delay of Apple's eagerly awaited wireless AirPods has to do with a problem surrounding the Bluetooth streaming of audio to the AirPods. Bluetooth specifications don't allow for simultaneous streaming of audio to two separate devices. In this case, it would be one in one ear, the other device in the other ear. So hardware makers resort to sending the signal to one earpiece and then wirelessly transmitting along to the other earpiece from there. But this can result in sync issues. It can result in dropouts. And, you know, still no word from Apple as to when these will get their release. But this is just kind of, well, not that I feel bad for a company like Apple. It's making billions and gillions and jillions of dollars off their products because I think they're doing all right. But you have to imagine that part of the plan here was to get this out in time for Christmas, in time for the holidays. And as far as we can tell, we're not going to see that.
If only we could figure out a way to get our head out of the way there between.
Yeah, I know.
Put our head somewhere besides between our two ears.
Totally. Our heads are the problem. Solution. We need to remove the head.
So Braggy has a similar pair of totally wireless Bluetooth headphones, and they do it. I mean, they've sold a bunch. I don't know. And it's only $150. So I don't know how they're doing it. Or maybe they're, you know, maybe people are having problems with it as well. Mm-hmm. What I find fascinating about this is, you know, they announced these AirPods. We looked at them. Everyone said, these are the ugliest things. We're going to lose them right away. I can't believe. And then now we're like, I want them. I'm so mad they're not here. These things that I hated.
You want them because you can't have them. It's brilliant.
Right.
It's brilliant.
It's what my grandmother used to always say. Like, we go to a restaurant she didn't like, and she's like, oh, the food is horrible and such small portions.
Give me more of this food that I don't like, please. Because at
exactly.
least I could be full.
Yeah, hurry up and give me these AirPods that I do not want.
It should be noted that Bluetooth SIG is in the process of updating the technology spec, basically, to allow for simultaneous endpoints, which makes a lot of sense. And Apple is on the board, you know, is part of the advisory of that. So that also makes sense that they would want to push that through. And I think that would be beneficial to, you know, obviously other OEMs, not just Apple. But yeah, I guess we'll see when this happens. Just not looking like by Christmas. It's not going to be a stocking stuffer if you thought it was going to be. Although Rene Ritchie, when he was here last week, he showed them off a little bit. It was really cool to see the little charging dock and kind of see how it all worked and snapped in there and everything. It's a cool kit. Just don't know when we're going
to
see it.
Yeah, he didn't seem to have problems with his connecting, but I don't know. I mean, I have never tried Bluetooth headphones that are truly wireless, like the ones that I have, the ones that connect around your back,
right,
the back of your head. I love the Jabra Sport Pulse. Those are $130 plus Sport Plus. And the BTS Sport Pro, those are great. They have GPS on them. They're from 66 Audio. And the GPS is great. If you lose them, you can just go on the app and then they'll ping it. So, you know, you can find them pretty easily. And also the Plantronics Backbeat Fit. So all of those would fit in anyone's stocking. Those are only $100. And all of them are great for runners, too.
Nice.
Forbes has released its second annual list of the most highly paid YouTube stars. Not surprisingly, PewDiePie topped the list, grossing a cool $15 million for doing something.
Yeah,
I cannot tell you what he does because I do not care. I do know that PewDiePie, whose real name is Felix Kilgberg, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, and I'm glad to pronounce it wrong, he threatened to delete his YouTube channel once he reached 50 million subscribers, due to a change in users' recommended or suggested videos. That's what he was protesting, allegedly. And he wanted, because I guess they're changing something because they want to promote more advertising-friendly content, and perhaps his content is not as advertising-friendly. I don't know. But when he reached those 50 million subscribers, he did not delete his account. He deleted a smaller second channel, and he said the whole thing about deleting the main account, that was a joke. I also don't know what he did on the second account because I also do not care about that. But I do know that he still has just over 50 million subscribers on his main account. And as for the others on the list, I have not heard of most of them, but your children probably have.
Yeah, probably so. I mean, the nummy, the cooking one.
Oh, nerdy cooking?
Yeah,
I never heard of that, but
whatever.
She seemed awesome.
Yeah, that's actually really
Nerdy Chef?
I've seen it. I don't watch it, but I've seen it. I've encountered it, let's say, some of the other ones I haven't. But this isn't just YouTube income, from what I could gather. This is based on data from Nielsen, IMDb, and as well as a whole multitude of sources, interviews with these people, also the people that work for these people, all that sort of stuff. So there's a lot of kind of inference happening on here from all of these sources. And I mean, money's not just coming in from YouTube. Obviously, there's the pre-roll, there's in-show sponsorships, but they've got the really successful ones are employing their fan base, with merchandise. They've got books that automatically have this huge following that are going to rush out and buy the books. Cameos in traditional media. PewDiePie has a couple of mobile games, which, as far as I could tell, just rough back of the napkin math, was probably making somewhere around like $15,000 a week, just on video game sales stuff. That could be inaccurate, but. That's what I saw.
I don't know what I do not want to know what those games are. Do not tell me, because I do not want to know.
One of them is, I will tell you, one of them is like a tuber simulator, like a YouTube simulator.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
If you want to pretend to be PewDiePie on YouTube.
Are you telling me because I keep talking about Westworld and you have to have a way to get me back?
Yeah. When you talk about Westworld, I'm going to talk about PewDiePie.
Awesome.
Even though I don't even know if I've ever watched an entire video of PewDiePie's, but I'm going to do it anyways.
Well, number 9 on the list is Colleen Ballinger. Who does Miranda Sings, which I love her channel. It's hilarious. And she has a Netflix show now. A lot of them are branching out into traditional media. And so that's a lot where the money comes. And there are 4 newcomers on the list, which I guess that means that you too could still be a YouTube star.
Ha.
But I don't really think that. I don't know. I mean, it's getting less and less of a chance. There's the average YouTube account has 238 subscribers.
Sounds about right.
That is not very many.
But it's so easy to look at what YouTube is and what people are famous for doing, and there's an aspirational quality quality to that. Suddenly I can't talk. Aspirational quality to it, where you see that and you're like, oh, I could totally do that.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I not doing that and making $7 million a year doing that? But
we don't make $7 million a year. At least I don't make $7 million a year.
I'm working on my book. I plan on putting all of my followers to work.
But I mean, I was thinking that probably a lot of you were thinking, I could do that. Which,
and we would love to
can.
See you try. See how it goes. Let us know.
I think people could absolutely do what I do.
Michigan is now ahead of the rest of the country when it comes to regulating autonomous driving by signing 4 state bills into law that don't require a driver in the seat, don't require a steering wheel, any pedals, and allows for autonomous taxi services in the state and autonomous tractor trailers. The requirement there being that there's a human somewhere on board, but really open wide these rules are. Many of the decisions around testing autonomous vehicles in the state will fall into the hands of automakers and the technology companies that are testing them. Of course, those technology companies and automakers were also part of helping to structure this, as were Uber and Lyft. They were heavily involved in this, but of course, Google and a bunch of the other companies that you expect to kind of be in there. And this allows for the sale of self-driving cars in the state once safety has been, quote, tested and certified. So Michigan going all in.
Yeah, this, of course, is the heart of the nation's auto industry. So it's good to see them. I am a big fan of self-driving cars. I would also like them to be regulated. So they say that self-driving cars can be sold to the public, but there's still no way to know how you get a license. Like, these laws didn't have any, like, licensing to, I mean, I guess not drive, but own, like,
sit. Could I get a passenger license for my car that I own, please?
Yeah, there seems to be a few holes. And then there's nothing in the legislation about teaching people safety about this, because I mean, that's of course what we saw with Tesla, right? Like, here's this autopilot, which isn't as autopilot-y as it sounds,
right?
And people don't know how to use it safely, or they don't want to use it safely. I don't know. I mean, this is using your car in a non-safe way is it's been happening for decades and decades.
That
at
is
first
true.
We were drinking, now we're texting. So I guess that's nothing new.
You would hope that they would encourage safety in that regard.
Right.
And not having that here. I don't know. It just really sounds like they say that this is about helping government support this growing industry without interfering with it or intervening or whatever. And I'm sure it's partially that. I really just kind of feel like it's about stimulating Michigan, kind of, you know, the audio industry again, jobs within the state, and really just kind of trying to realize, recognizing that Michigan at one time was so vital and important to the auto industry. That was its life's blood. Now it's less so, and here's an opportunity to be there again. So they open it all up and encourage all this sort of stuff that other states would be very hesitant to do. California, Nevada require drivers in the seats of these cars, require certain things that Michigan just isn't. And I think it's just kind of Michigan being like, well, what do we got to lose? Let's see how this goes. Let's be there from the start.
Yeah. And I mean, if they're bringing jobs there, you know, as opposed to bringing jobs to Silicon Valley where no one can afford to live,
right.
You know, it's yeah. great. Like, you know, Detroit, places like that are much less expensive.
Well, yeah, that's a really good point. All of these big name companies that are testing these things, I mean, now they're going to go to Michigan because that's where it's completely unencumbered and unintruded. You know, they can pretty much run these tests the way that they want to. And Michigan just got a huge, you know, influx of people coming to the state and spending their money there and who knows what else.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a new way to access mixed reality with your iPhone, but it's kind of expensive and maybe even a little bit ugly. However, it has an onboard structural center. It's full inside-out positional tracking, no high-end PC required, no markers, no external cameras needed. It's designed for augmented reality, but you can also use current iPhone VR apps with it as well. Now, Bridge, that's what it's called. It's from Occipital. It runs on their newly created Bridge engine to run entirely on device. Everything that you're going to do is on device. The headset also uses a custom glass lens, and it'll cost you $400 unless you want to buy the Explorer Edition for $500. That ships December 15th, and it includes a T-shirt. So the cheaper one without the T-shirt you won't get until March. So we talked about Occipital and the Bridge, I guess, VR developers kit back in September. I don't really remember talking about them, but when I looked it up, there it was, us talking about this. So it's already in the works. It's cool because I think, it's hard to do, all of the cell phone VR seems to be mostly, requires a Pixel or a Samsung phone.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to see iPhone obviously get some sort of kind of next level virtual reality kind of platform outside of cardboard, which is really kind of what your or plastic versions of cardboard, which is what have kind of existed there. You're paying a little bit more obviously to get in on that with this system. $500 is pretty expensive no matter how you slice it, you know.
You could slice it this way. It's much cheaper than the HoloLens.
When you're factoring in computer and all that kind of stuff, absolutely. I mean, the whole inside-out approach of this is pretty intriguing to see it all happening. Structure sensor, you know, first was born back in 2013 with a Kickstarter. It was a super successful Kickstarter. That was for bringing this 3D like depth sensing to iPads and stuff. Then you could get it for $379 just for that technology. So you're not paying that much more now. And, you know, you can now use your iPhone in more of a VR or AR sort of sense. So I think this is great. I'd love to play around with it. It looks pretty, pretty compelling.
I agree. Yeah. I walked into Jerry and Anthony's office. They were also watching this video and are looking to try to feature this on the screensavers.
Oh, cool.
As well. And also Tanya shot them an email and said, we would love to review this. So I may regret calling it maybe ugly, but it kind of is.
It's futuristic.
Yeah, futuristic. Very futuristic looking.
We just don't understand the future yet, so we want to call it ugly. But soon, mm-hmm. everybody's going to be wearing these things.
It's true.
Oh, yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Up next, we'll take a closer look at Apple's efforts in artificial intelligence. But first, let's take a minute to thank Blue Apron. They are the sponsor of this episode. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with fresh, high-quality ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. Every meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. You're going to save time. You'll save money. Shopping at the grocery store is 60% more expensive than what you get with Blue Apron. If you spend a lot eating out and it adds up quick, or at high-end grocery stores, well, here you can spend under $10 per person for healthy home-cooked meals. Customize your recipes every week based on your dietary preferences, whatever they happen to be, and you can choose a delivery option that fits your needs. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Blue Apron delivers to 99% of the continental U.S. and sets the highest quality standards for their community of over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. And Blue Apron not only supports a more sustainable food system, it supports happy and healthy families. Because when you cook together, you build strong family bonds. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly three times more often. I know in our kitchen with Blue Apron, our, you know, at least our oldest daughter, she would totally get involved because it's all pre-portioned. So it's super easy. It's like, yeah, now dump that in. And that's all that we have to do. So she gets to be a part of the process without having to, you know, bring sharp knives into the whole scenario. And that's a whole other level. New recipes are created every week with Blue Apron's culinary team at the controls there. They're not repeated within a year. So you've got roasted pork and braised cabbage with barley and glazed apples. There's Thai green coconut curry. That sounds awesome. With sweet potato and jasmine rice. Brown butter and chestnut gnocchi with Brussels sprouts and pea shoot salad. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And we thank Blue Apron for their support of Tech News Today. Blue Apron is a better way to cook.
Apple is notoriously secretive about most things that go on behind closed Cupertino doors, but this is especially true when it comes to their AI and self-driving car research. But our guest today wrote about a secret meeting with the new head of Apple's machine learning team, Russ Solokudinov, and other Apple employees. Dave Gershgorn from Quartz is here to talk about some of the topics that Apple talked about in that meeting. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So what was the purpose of this invite-only meeting?
So basically what it seemed like was Apple wanted to hold this little lunch to talk with a lot of people from the machine learning, artificial intelligence community, and just kind of catch them up to speed. So people from Google, startups, Microsoft, you name it, people were there to kind of hear about what's been going on behind closed doors. And I think Apple wanted to keep some of it kind of on the hush. It was invite only. They didn't really tell any press about it. The news kind of first leaked when somebody tweeted that Apple was going to start publishing their work, and then a few other people started tweeting about it. But what also happened inside the meeting was Apple gave a pretty deep dive on a lot of the other projects that they've been working on. Some notable things are like how they're going to actually make decisions based on your health data, detection of like LiDAR and how to track something that moves in a 3D space, and even, I guess, like the simple things like making Siri better.
And you talked about how they're actually going to be able to make neural networks smaller, which makes sense for Apple because they sell mobile phones and small devices. Did the slides that you had access to give you any idea of how they would make neural networks smaller than they already are?
Yeah, so this is actually fascinating, and it's something that I think is going to kind of really catch on for a few different reasons. So the way that they do this is they have this kind of large, very robust neural network where it's something that they feed it a lot of data, maybe, you know, anonymized user data. On one of the other slides, they say that they use a 2.2 million images, which is almost double kind of like standard image recognition database. And they have this big, huge thing, but it's way too big to put on a phone. So what they do is they have a tiny network just kind of ask it questions. And they kind of, what would you do in this situation? What would you do in this situation? And that way it kind of learns the way that the larger network would make a decision without needing all that data. And what's also cool about that is it obscures the data that the larger network actually learned in the first place, because there have been attacks that kind of are able to figure out the training data if it's not obscured. So a different way to think about it is, say you have a friend and you want to buy them a clothes for Christmas and you want to know their taste in clothes. So you ask them, how do you like this scarf? And you show them a scarf and they're like, eh, it's all right. And then you say, how do you like these pants? And they say, oh, I love those pants. And then you ask them all these different questions about clothes. You have a knowledge of what they would do in certain situations and how they would buy clothes, but you don't have access to anything else that they know besides that. And you also don't have access to the experiences that made them like, you know, blue jeans over khakis or something like that. So that's a way to think about like that kind of like disembodied knowledge that's just encapsulated in a tiny neural network that's able to run on a phone way faster.
Right. So Apple's big on like on the device. So maybe we'd even be able to run in our AirPods if we ever get them, and I could keep it in my.
That'll never happen. We're never getting them.
Yeah, if we ever get them.
If we ever we'll get see. Them, then it could like, you know, just feed me questions all the time and my daily life. Oh. I could talk to people.
Yeah. So they basically just want to make these things as small as possible because nothing like they don't want to put it on iCloud. They don't want to have it on the servers. Although there was a slide about the servers as well, where they might be building their own GPUs to run deep learning processes because they kind of showed these like Apple GPUs against Amazon Web Services, and it ran like twice as fast with a third of the GPUs. And it's this really interesting thing that Apple is kind of making their own kind of standalone AI outfit. And they've been doing it very much in the shadows. But it could emerge that they've been right all along and we were wrong to underestimate them. But I'm sure that's also what they want me to be saying right now. So it's kind of tough to gauge with Apple because they've always been so secretive. And now they're just starting to come out a little bit.
That really ties right into kind of my main question here. And we've asked it on the show, or we've discussed it on the show a few times in the past, because it seems like more and more companies like Apple, who we're so used to seeing them be so secretive about the things that they haven't released yet, or the machinations of everything that happens behind the scenes, they're starting to really kind of open up aspects of their research when it comes to AI specifically. What do they gain by doing this? I mean, is it just this greater kind of base of knowledge without giving away too much that they all benefit from?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is talent. They recognize that there are only maybe a dozen schools in the U.S. that are putting out like top tier, cream of the crop, 1% machine learning researchers, and they need access to that. And you know, if these people are looking at companies that they're going to go to, they kind of have their pick if they're really good. So they can go to Google and they have open access to publish, and they can talk with their friends about their research, and like they can kind of collaborate and make this great future that people want from AI. And going to work with Apple has traditionally been like, all right, you get a new job, but you can't go to the bar and talk with your friends anymore. Like you can't, discuss your research. You can't collaborate with other people. And I think that's also why research outfits like OpenAI have attracted some really, really good talent in AI, is because they are saying that you can work with everyone. You know, anybody who wants to work with them is kind of, you know, it's open game. They work with Google all the time. There's a lot of collaboration. They have open, you know, collaboration with NVIDIA. They're funded by, I think, a bunch of different companies. So openness is very much kind of like the name of the game right now. And Apple is kind of catching up, and they're saying that we can't be big players. We can't recruit top level talent if we don't kind of play this game. And it's actually, I think it's awesome because it's something where like these researchers are winning this war. It's very much a priority to them that this research happens in the open, and it happens in a way that's accountable. So I think it's a really smart move for Apple, but it's also kind of a good thing for the entire ecosystem of people who are making AI, designing systems around it. And we don't know, like they haven't published anything. It'll probably be few and far between what they do publish. But the fact that they're coming to the table, I think, does mean a lot.
Yeah.
And so their new head of machine learning, Russ Solokudinov, he's from Carnegie Mellon. So, I mean, he's an academic researcher. Do you think him at the helm will change their willingness to share and publish more?
Totally. I wouldn't be surprised if it was something that he kind of brought on entirely. I mean, the timing is kind of suspect for that. He's only been there for a few months, and it seems that they kind of brought him on to tell them how they can get ahead and how they can kind of keep up with, if not lead the pack in recruiting top level talent. Because it's not like people don't want to work for Apple, but it's just it's a really difficult decision to make to kind of like give up a lot of professional connections. And when I've spoken to AI researchers in the past, I mean, a lot of them will say that, you know, we do have friends at Apple and we talk to them kind of like, you know, on the hush hush, and we kind of know what's going on there. But it's a big difference between being able to talk at a, you know, at a bar versus collaborate on something that's, you know, meaningful and you can, that creates value for the community and both companies.
So they also talked about in the slides, there's information about machine learning and LiDAR, you know, the technology in self-driving cars. Does that make you think that they do have a car in the works?
It's one of those things where it's like, well, it's, I don't know, like how many things are, is Apple going to do that they're going to use LiDAR for? but it's, and there are pictures of little cars, like it's very stock arty. But you know, my sources there were like, they didn't say the word car, they didn't say the word automotive. Don't infer anything from this. But I mean, you can infer a little bit. Like the iPhone doesn't have a LiDAR sensor on it. The iPhone doesn't. My MacBook doesn't.
Maybe self-driving AirPods that could drive themselves right into your ears.
I like that.
That's the delay. They put LiDAR in it, so you can just close your eyes and Siri will direct you around. It's perfect.
Okay, well, one last question before we let you go. You also had a piece in Quartz today about Boston Dynamic robot dogs that might be delivering your items to your home. Could you tell us just a little bit about that?
Totally. So I think Boston Dynamics is really just looking for, they're throwing stuff on the wall. And they're like, all right, what are we going to do with these robots? They're like incredibly robust. They can walk on anything. They're not like super, they're not backed by a lot of AI right now. A lot of it's kind of pre-programmed. But they are thinking about like what we're going to do. Like we have something that can grasp a door handle and turn it and, you know, maybe knock on a door, throw a package somewhere. And they haven't really worked for military uses. They haven't successfully been able to sell the company what they were trying to do. And they're seeing, hey, maybe we'll deliver them. But there's a little bit of like a weird friction in the idea that you're going to use like $1 million machine to deliver a pizza or like a water bottle. It's much easier to just put a little like robot with four wheels and just let it go. So it would be awesome. Like I personally would love to have the Boston Dynamics robot kind of like walk up and I can give it a little high five and it's cool hand thing. And then it'll give me my pizza. But realistically, I don't know if it's going to happen, but the guy said it, that the CEO of the company was said that this is like a possibility. Probably a small one.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us. You have the best title ever, Artificial Intelligence Reporter. Like it sort of implies. So that's why we really wanted to have you on, to see that you were real and not just an AI. Okay.
Yes, my first few days, everyone was like, they would come up to me like, all right, robot or not? And I am real. So you can have that assurance.
Awesome. Well, you can find Dave's work about robots and AI at QZ.com, at Quartz, and Dave Gorn on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on.
Great.
Thank you, Dave. Have a great night.
Take care.
We'll talk to you soon. John from St. Louis, Missouri writes, recently I received a pop-up on my Galaxy 7 stating that my phone was infected and would self-destruct in a week unless I downloaded the virus protection app Avira Antivirus and removed the virus. Since I have been using Lookout for several years, I felt I was protected and the warning was a scare tactic and ignored it. After listening to episode 1651 about bad guys stealing Gmail tokens to force more installs, I felt this was another scam to increase installs. This app is in the Play Store, the Google Play Store. I believe he's talking about Avira. Doesn't Google have a policy against app providers trying to scare users into installing their apps? So I did some kind of looking around on this. And I mean, it's hard to say exactly how the pop-up started. Some people have downloaded apps from, let's say, third-party stores or worse places, and that can put things into your phone that will do things like this. I'm thinking that might not have been the case, though, here. Could have been the result, it could have been served up by a web page. This is a pretty common thing where it serves it up, looks legitimate, and I'm guessing a lot here based on what you wrote, but it could have said click this to install Avast. But following that, if you had done that, possibly would not have even installed Avast. It might have installed Avast, but it would also install something else in there, which would be the payload to infect your device, right? So I'm happy you didn't install that. I'm thinking it had nothing to do with Avast. I don't think Avast popped this up like as an opportunity to advertise to you. I think Avast is a recognizable, trustable antivirus software that was used in the description to try and convince you to download this, to click that link to install it.
Is Avira the same thing as Avast?
Or sorry, is it, did I get, sorry, Avast, I
Maybe
got
he
the
meant
two.
Avast.
I got the two confused, but Avira antivirus is what I'm talking about. Okay. Sorry, Avast is okay. A different one, but yeah.
And do you use Lookout?
No.
And you don't think you need to?
No. I don't. Really, I mean, ultimately, for me anyways, it's a matter of recognizing, like, as long as I don't execute something that I don't want to execute, it's not going to install on my phone. And so, you know, don't click that, because doing that might execute it. It might just download it, and then you still have to run it to execute it. Yeah, I mean, a lot of times it's just kind of, you know, just use good judgment, I suppose. And don't get your stuff from third party. I'm not saying that you did, but if you get your apps from third party places, you've actually, in order to install that, you have to lower the security on your Android device. Specifically, you have to check off this box that says, yes, allow me to install things like this. And you're just kind of opening yourself up to trouble there. If you don't know or understand the place that you got that from, you never truly know what's baked into that file that you're installing.
Well, after the break, we've invited Kyle Orland from Ars Technica to tell us if the new Super Mario Run on iOS is as much fun as the Super Mario fan site that he created in 1997. But first, let's take a minute to thank Tracker, the sponsor of this episode. It's that time of year. Don't lose your luggage or your valuable gifts this holiday season. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past, and I'll tell you how to get one for free. The Tracker Bravo locates misplaced keys, wallets, luggage, instruments, bicycles, electronic devices, even pets in seconds. The coin-sized device is constructed with anodized aluminum for the thinnest, most durable tracking. Now, you can easily attach it to your keys or use the adhesive on the back and stick it right to something. That's what I do with my kids' trumpet cases. It's just stuck right in there, and they leave them places, and I have found them using the tracker several times. You can add a laser-engraved message to each Tracker Bravo, like a return information or your pet's name. You can now personalize your tracker with a custom printed image. Help loved ones keep track of their new gadgets. Trackers make great stocking stuffers. Pair a tracker to your iOS or your Android device and find its precise location with a tap of a button. It's that easy. Your phone can track up to 10 devices at once. Here's what else you can do. You can customize two-way separation alerts so you're notified before you leave your item behind. And if you lose your phone, all you have to do is press the button on your tracker, and then your phone will ring even if you've put it on silent. There are over 3.5 million devices shipped. That means that Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the whole world, so your lost item shows up on a map even if it's miles away. If you lose your item, the Tracker app records its last known location on a map. When another Tracker user comes within 100 feet of your item, you'll receive a GPS update of where your item is. Go to thetracker.com and never lose your possessions again, or if you lose them, you can find them. Plus, just for our audience, if you enter promo code TNT, you'll get a free Tracker Bravo with your order. That's thetracker.com, promo code TNT to get your free Tracker Bravo today.
Super Mario Run, the hotly anticipated iOS game that'll hit the App Store on December 15th, can be tested out right now if you're willing to hike yourself into an Apple Store. Kyle Orland from Ars Technica did just that, and he survived to talk about it today. We talked to him about it. How are you doing, Kyle?
Hi, I'm pretty good. I survived the Apple Store and made it out.
Well done. Somehow. First of all, pat on the back for making it out to the Apple Store to check this out. I've actually been tempted because I really want to play this game. First of all, what were your thoughts on gameplay after your time with it?
So it was interesting. It really looks like a Mario game. It looks exactly like the assets you'd expect from the new Super Mario Brothers series, right down to the coin sound effects. Bowser looks right, the Goombas and everything. But that look really fools you into thinking that it's going to be the kind of Mario game you're used to, you know, the kind of 2D game you've been playing for the last 30 years now. It's not really like that at all. And the big difference, obviously, is that you can't move left. Mm-hmm. You can't back up. If you see in that picture there, you can't get those coins below Mario on the left because you're jumping for those ones above. Usually in a Mario game, you'd get that red coin and then, you know, loop back around and get the coins down there. You want to be completist or, you know, mm-hmm. get an extra life. No, this you have to choose a path at many points and go for one set of coins or go for the other. It's not always clear at the moment which one you want to do, and you have to make these split-second decisions. It's just requires a mental gear shift from what you're used to.
Yeah, in some ways, I mean, it's not an endless runner, but in some ways it kind of feels that way because you've got a certain path, you're always going in that direction, and I mean, you make your decision and you keep moving, and that's kind of at the heart of an endless runner series.
Yeah, it's in the style of an endless runner, but these are designed levels that are mm-hmm. meant to finish, and you see the timer up there, less than 60 seconds, so it's a very quick play experience, and it's not the kind of, you know, random roguelike levels there. Every time it's going to be different. When you're playing in this mode, it's going to be the same when you're playing through these levels every time. You can unlock new challenges, but that's about it. You're really just going for a high score. I don't know how long that's really going to appeal to people. There's only 24 levels to start that you get for $10. And I feel like you could really, if you're good, you could get through those in an hour or two. It's not the kind of mobile game like, you know, Pokemon Go or something where there's really the incentive in this mode, at least, to keep going on forever and ever. Mm-hmm. We'll have to see when the full game comes out if the other modes really help with that.
Does it feel, when I play, you know, the classic Nintendo games created by Nintendo, you know, and definitely the marquee ones like the Super Mario series, like there's a certain like authentic Nintendo seal of approval, seal of quality that you get when you play those games, satisfaction that you're playing this higher level, you know, of quality, just all about fun sort of experience. Did you get that with this, or was it kind of tampered a little bit?
So I only played the first 3.5 levels. The fourth level stops after 20 seconds or so, but those levels felt designed. They really felt like they weren't just throwing a bunch of random coins. It wasn't like, you know, some of the fan-made Super Mario Maker levels that you see where really the people have no idea what they're doing. This seemed like it came from Nintendo designers who really know what makes a satisfying level. But that said, it still didn't feel like any Mario level I'd played before because you can't explore to your heart's content. You're just moving forward. You're deciding over and over and over again, do I go up? Do I go down? And once you've made that decision, you're done until, you know, you try the level over again, I guess. It made me kind of twitchy a little bit to, you know, go for one set of coins and know that I was, you know, missing an item down there because that's not how I play Mario games.
Right, yeah.
So Nintendo is sadly not part of my nostalgia, but what is part of my nostalgia is websites that were made in 1997 about things that people really, really loved. And you have one. So you created one of the first Mario fan sites. It's still up. It's amazing.
Yes.
SMBHQ.com.
Super Mario Brothers headquarters.
So you know your stuff about Super Mario.
I feel like we should.
I'd like to think so. Yeah, I started that when I was 15 after I got learn HTML in 21 days from my mom for Hanukkah. And who knew that it would lead to all of this? You know, I remember back then feeling I really had hit the big time because I had to check my AOL email every day because I was getting up to 2 emails a day from people who were visiting this website. It used to be I would check it once a week and maybe, you know, get a few emails, and people were emailing me, and they really wanted, you know, in-depth information about these things, and they didn't know I was just this teenager who had a lot of Nintendo powers in his basement. They really treated me as an authority just because I was on the web, and, you know, now 20 years later, that's what I do for a living, so I guess I got my first taste of it and liked it.
I love that, because the other thing that you brought up in this piece was demos. DMOZ, the web organized, which I just had totally forgotten that had slipped out of my mind, but I remember that. Like I used to work at search engines, like try, you know, in the beginning, early days, and that was amazing. Like, and then you were one of the first Mario Brothers sites to be listed there.
The Mushroom Kingdom was the other one, and they're still around. They're still updating. Super Mario Brothers headquarters has kind of gone defunct now, as you know, I go to do other things. If I could make a Mario fan site and actually make a living off of just writing about Mario, that would be great. I know some other people do that with other games, but I don't think the Mario fan base is really enough to make it a going concern. But yeah, back in the day, pre-Google, being listed on the Open Directory project was the way people found you. And I remember when I first saw Google, the first thing I searched for was Mario. And I remember Super Mario Brothers headquarters was on the front page, partly because the Open Directory was so trusted. It gave it a lot of page weight, I guess. And that really made me feel like I was starting to make a difference in this, you know, early net.
Well, you never know. Super Mario Run might invigorate you to keep up updating the site, maybe bring it back to life again. There was news earlier today that I read that said that this game is going to require an always-on connection. Do you think there's a good reason for that? What's your take on that?
From what I hear, piracy is a big problem on the mobile space. You know, it's not coming to Android yet, but when there is an Android version, it's supposedly much worse on there. I've heard reports that, you know, 9 out of 10 or even more copies of some very popular games on Android are pirated. Nintendo, obviously, it does not want that. That's probably a large part of the reason they've been reluctant to come into mobile up to this point. You know, now they can't ignore it. You know, in practice, I feel like unless you're on an airplane, where do you really not have cellular data? Maybe if you're traveling internationally, maybe if you're on a subway, there are use cases. But, you know, for most people, a lot of the time, they're going to have data. The real question is how much data it's going to send. Right. Just checking that it's an official copy shouldn't really take up a lot of your data plan. But if it's, you know, really megabytes and megabytes over and over again, that's going to really annoy people.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Now, the markets have responded pretty positively to Nintendo, especially in the most recent months, probably ever since Pokemon Go became a thing and leading on. Certainly, that's going to continue as we head into the new year with the release of this heading in. How is 2017 looking for Nintendo, in your opinion? Obviously, we've got the Switch down the line. Is this going to be a good year, do you think?
I think it'll be a good year for Nintendo relatively. The last 4 years, you know, dominated by the Wii U, have really just not been good. They've clawed themselves back into profitability for some quarters, but really they put so much money into a console that just didn't catch on at all. And after, you know, the huge unexpected success of the Wii, that's a really tough turn to take. All indications are that the Switch is kind of a return to form. It gets rid of the control gimmicks and the tablet, the touchscreen that really limited the Wii and the Wii U. So I think that could bring some people back who were a little reluctant on the last consoles. As far as the mobile side, I think Pokemon Go is already starting to decline. It was really hot for a while, but you know, there's kind of not much to do after you've caught, you know, a few dozen Pokemon. You can't really go anywhere with that. Super Mario Run, it's probably going to do well at first, but I don't see it being a moneymaker going forward for month after month after month, like some of these biggest mobile games. It's going to be kind of a one-time hit, and I don't know that it's going to really make as much money as a company, big concern like Nintendo, really needs to make a dent in their process. So it's really all going to come down to the Switch. You know, we're getting more information about that in January. If they come out with a really strong launch lineup, you know, a Mario game, maybe some I anticipated third-party titles that are recent and can convince people that Nintendo is not just, you know, the nostalgia company, but it's also a company that some of these big publishers are going to get behind, then, yeah, maybe they have a chance to be a player in the console space again.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kyle Orland, always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for coming on today and taking some minutes out of your evening to chat with us about Nintendo. Appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Excellent. ArsTechnica.com and at Kyle Orl on Twitter. Thanks again, Kyle. We'll talk to you soon.
TNT's fan of the day is David Sheneman, who wrote to us on Twitter saying he's listening to Tech News Today while he does the dishes. Awesome.
Also, we don't get a picture.
No, but he says he doesn't like tater tots. We get an opinion, which we asked for because we said we never met anyone who didn't like tater tots.
Whatever, David.
So, David, Tickets at twit.tv. We'd love to meet you. Come see the studio, and Padre will make you the best tater tots you've ever had. We would like to change your opinion about tater tots.
Yeah, they're the perfect amount of crispy, nice and soft on the inside. That is so good.
Yes.
So good.
Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Record a video, take a picture of yourself or your setup, post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, Facebook, or just email it to TNT@twit.tv. We will find it. If it's out on the interwebs, hashtag how I watch TNT. That's how we'll find it there.
Yes. Coming up, Stephen Hawking has something to say about a future world filled with artificial intelligence. But first, let's take a minute to thank LinkedIn Learning and Lynda.com. They're the sponsor of this episode. LinkedIn acquired Lynda.com to bring you LinkedIn Learning. It's personalized, expert-led, on-demand e-learning from LinkedIn. LinkedIn Learning is now offering a free course, Managing Technical Projects, led by project management expert Bob McGannon. Technical projects have a unique set of needs and challenges. New technology has to be researched, downtime must be kept to a minimum, and the organization must be helped to adapt to the change. In this course, McGannon discusses specific approaches to mitigating the risk and challenges common with technology projects. He presents specific challenges for you to explore, including possible conflicts with stakeholders and vendors. McGannon also reviews case studies to bring concepts to life. You can compare your solutions with McGannon's recommendations to kind of see how your project management skills compare against the best. Don't miss this great course and more than 9,000 courses currently available at LinkedIn Learning. There's so many to choose from. They cover all sorts of topics. Team solutions are available for as low as $2,000 per year. LinkedIn Learning will identify the precise skills your organization needs to achieve set goals and will create personalized recommendations using LinkedIn Network Intelligence. Their library offers a wide range of business, creative, and technology courses, all taught by world-class industry experts. So you can learn anytime, anywhere, on any device, online or offline. And they have the bite-sized videos, really easy to consume there, provide immediate problem-solving, and are the perfect way to help team members close a skills gap without interrupting your latest project. They can just drop right in, get the knowledge they need, and get back to work. Get your free Managing Technical Projects course and request a demo for your organization today. All you have to do is visit learning.linkedin.com/twit. That's learning.linkedin.com/twit. And we thank LinkedIn Learning for their support of Tech News Today. So back in October, physicist Stephen Hawking, arguably one of the smartest minds of our day, was speaking in Cambridge, where he had some thoughts to share about the current trend toward artificial intelligence, and basically it's Terminator 2. He compared human intelligence to machine intelligence, basically arguing that each are in parity in their potential to replicate each other. As such, he says it could be assumed that computers could someday emulate human intelligence to the point where it could develop its own will that might conflict with your will. And I have not seen Westworld, but I'm pretty sure this is the part where Megan says something about Westworld.
The Westworld jokes are not for you, Jason.
Why not?
They are not for you.
Am I wrong?
They are not for you.
But am I wrong?
The jokes are not for you. You're not wrong. Humans are horrible. They're flawed. If we could create an AI that wasn't that, why don't we just go ahead and do it? I mean, really, we're horrible people.
Well, if we're horrible people, then the machines are going to realize that they just need to get rid of us.
Well, maybe they should, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Okay. Oh, this is a bleak kicker.
I know. Well, Hawking had this essay in The Guardian last week that was amazing. Basically, he said this is the most dangerous time for our planet. And it was scary. I mean, and it's partly automation. That's partly it. It's partly the elections, you know, in Brexit and the elections here and just people having a voice and saying, like, no, I don't like the way things are going and how people who disagree with that respond to that. And this and it's key. He says, you know, he talks about automation. He says, you know, only the most caring, creative or supervisory roles will remain. You know, it's just automation is going to happen. We can't stop it. And he says we have the means to destroy our world, but not to escape it. So happy Friday, everyone.
He finished by saying the rise of powerful AI will either be the best or the worst thing to ever happen to humanity. Cool.
It could be the best thing. Let's make it the best.
Yeah, that's the first thing he said. Unfortunately, he ended it with the bad one. And that's the last impression that is made on my brain. And to be fair, because I know some people might email, this isn't the first time that he's talked about this stuff. This is definitely a recurring kind of topic of thought of Stephen Hawking. But anytime, well, I respect his opinion. And dang, that's bleak. TNT records live every... I'm thrown off. I don't know how I can even do the rest of the show. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 11 p.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show if we have any more and the universe doesn't explode by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can find us on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV.
It's not us that has to worry. It's our great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
But you can show your allegiance to Twit with our new Twit Army gear. These shirts and hoodies will protect you from the robot apocalypse, and they're designed by the Twit staff, and they come in a variety of colors. If you order before December 15th, the shirts will arrive before Christmas. So go to teespring.com/twit to order yours today. We're also still working on our best of episodes, and I'm really working on my iOS Today best of episode. And so far, only one has been submitted, so I need some more.
So, come on, yeah, send those in.
TV/best of and submit any memories you have, just anything that you're interested in seeing in the best of episode. And subscribe to our show at twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me anything, Westworld quotes especially, I'm watching it all over again. So, and I'm at Megan Maroney.
I'm not going to tweet you those quotes because I don't know, and B, you told me not to joke around about Westworld because I don't know.
That was a Westworld joke.
Oh, see, I don't even know. I don't even know what I don't know.
That's why you should just see Saul Motor Functions.
Okay. I saw that in the chat room. That must be one also, right?
Yes.
Okay. Wow, I'm so clueless. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Kara. Thanks to Mario for the words and helping out here in the studio. Thanks to Kevin for editing and making us look good, I hope. And thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all on Monday. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.